That's right. It's time for another surveillance-free, EFF-approved episode of Healthy Paranoia, where passwords are always salted and the packets are always encrypted. I'm your host, Mrs. Y, queen of metadata and official privacy advocate for Healthy Paranoia. Today, I'm in the NSA-proofed skiff with Grex of NovaInfosec.com and ShmooCon FireTalks to discuss Windows forensics with Andrew Case, digital forensics researcher, Hacker Academy instructor, and core developer for the Volatility Framework. Welcome, everyone.
Hello.
Hey, how's it going?
I love the Volatility Framework, just FYI.
Yeah, I'm really, yep, okay, so I guess we're going to, like, love on the Volatility Framework a little bit, and this is a good time to mention that there's a significant upgrade to Volatility. Andrew?
Yeah, just recently we released the 2.3 version, which brought in some many new plugins. It's also the first version that had official Mac OS X support. The support for that runs all the way back to 10.5 through whatever the latest was at the time of release. I think that was 10.8, and then a week or so after we released, 10.9 came out, and then we added in support for that into what was a small 2.3.1 release just to bring in some of that new functionality. And then we also had improvements to, on the Linux side, we got official support for Android, so you can take the memory dumps of like Android devices and run those through Volatility, and there was also a number of new plugins added on the Windows side as well. So it was a pretty significant upgrade in the plugins that were in the standard release.
Yeah, I have to say, I was really impressed. I was at the Open Forensics Memory Workshop. Did I get that right? And I was impressed. So I don't have occasion to do much forensics in incident response work. I mean, it's very time-consuming in most organizations where I am. You know, you're one of a small team of people, and if you need that level of forensics, you're usually calling somebody in. But I was impressed with the scope of what Volatility could do, of what people are doing with it, the kind of plugins that are being written. It's a very, very powerful tool that I know I need to spend more time with. I mean, Grex, do you play with it a lot? Or
yeah, it just so happens I'm doing a little bit of forensics. It's just like it's teaching, so it's literally just the tip of the iceberg. But yeah, we use like part of our class actually uses the Volatility Framework, and so I'm getting a chance to use it there.
Oh, that's great.
Now I can tell the class that I talked to the guy that created it. They'll be very impressed.
Well, one of the guys. It's actually
one of the guys, yeah.
Yeah, it's a team of really cool people. And there's a really bright woman that's a developer on the team, and she's very impressive. I saw her talk. It was a great opportunity because I don't inhabit that world much. I'm more on the engineering side, the builder side. So it was great just having a chance to be completely paranoid about what little breadcrumbs I leave all over a system.
Yeah,
it was great. So
it's like from a privacy perspective, I've often, you know, now that I've seen a little bit of what forensics can do, especially with the Windows operating system, there's a part of me where my advice is to just, you know, full disk encryption and, you know, like that's right. Really the only protection because, yeah, there's just every little thing that you do on the Windows system leaves some trace.
Yes, you're never invisible. So let's jump right in. Andrew, it was great for you to mention. I know you're teaching a new class on specifically on Windows forensics and the registry. And I think it's great because there's a need for it out there. I mean, the registry is still such a mystery to most people. And I think it's great that by doing it through Hacker Academy, this new online delivery mechanism, your great knowledge is going to be have a chance to be exposed to many more people, and a lot more people are going to have the opportunity to learn more about Windows forensics. So how long have you been teaching this course before you were actually doing it specifically for Hacker Academy?
Well, we had quite a bit of the material. It was kind of rolled into other courses, like the one we do at Black Hat, the general forensics. And we saw a need where if you do even something at Black Hat where you're doing like a four-day course, the time you spend on the registry, because you have to cover a lot of other topics, we felt like we really wanted to bring something out that focused just on the registry. And the way the registry course kind of came about is it's equivalent to like 2 days of in-person training just on the registry, because there's so much information there that you really can't get through it all if you're only doing a half of a day or part of a day with it. And we wanted to put a single resource where people could go and kind of see all the things there are in the registry and all the ways you could analyze it and so on.
So, again, let's just, for people who don't have, you know, who don't work as part of a dedicated security team and maybe not, especially not doing forensics all the time, just quickly define your meaning of forensics.
So forensics to me is after some actions have occurred on the machine, coming behind the person that did it or the malware that did it or the attacker scripts that did it, and being able to find all of the artifacts that are left around. So as y'all were just saying, every time you do something on a Windows system, there's one or many things that are noted about that. There's signs that particular actions occurred on a machine, and forensics is the idea of knowing what all of those are, at least knowing what the great majority of them are, and then pulling them out in a way that you can definitively prove what a person did on the computer.
And this is important in terms of for legal discovery. It's important because you may need to build a case, or you may need to go to your insurance company to file a claim. And on the other side, knowing what malware did on a machine can help you know what data has been exfiltrated or what has been compromised, what you have to, you know, disclose for a breach report. So what are some of the challenges that you found? You mentioned that you have to spend a couple of days on it, and it really isn't enough in a live class. What are some of the challenges with Windows forensics in general?
In general, when you're dealing with Windows, one of the first problems you deal with is the fact that Microsoft doesn't really document anything. So when the switch happened from XP to Vista and then kind of quickly onto 7, there was a number of new artifacts, a number of new file formats. For instance, the way the recycle bin worked in Windows XP completely changed when Vista and 7 came around. And so all these people who knew how to do recycle bin forensics, there's a lot of really good information when you look inside the recycle bin. All the tools broke, all the processes broke, and things had to change. And then you also had, for instance, there was no notion of jump list before Windows 7. And a jump list is if you have, say, Word open or Notepad open and you right-click on the taskbar and you get the list of files that you recently accessed, that's stored within a database on disk that stores what files you accessed, the full path to them, the last time that you accessed them. And for a while, the forensics community didn't even know that was there. It took, I believe, Harlan Carvey was the first one to find it. And then at that point, he knew there was interesting things in the artifact, but then he had to reverse engineer the file format. So for all that time, these investigations were being done on Windows 7 machines, and a great artifact was there that wasn't even being looked at simply because it wasn't documented by Microsoft, and no one in the forensics community had found it yet.
Wow. So you mentioned Harlan Carvey. He has some great websites. He has a great website, and he has some good books out there, right, on forensics. Is he pretty much the go-to on that subject, or?
Yeah, particularly when you're looking at Windows disk forensics, Harlan's done just a huge amount of work in that space. He was the original author and pretty much still the sole author of RegRipper, which is a tool for he has a plugin-based system. He's written a number of plugins for pulling information out of the registry in a way that you don't have to look inside it yourself. The plugin pulls everything out and formats it for you. He also wrote, it has to be 3 or 4 or 5 books by now. Some of the books are kind of all on Windows forensics. He has an entire book on registry forensics. So he's definitely contributed quite a bit to the community. He also has his blog, windowsir.blogspot.com, which is pretty much up to date with the latest research. Even if he did it, he'll link to someone else who published things.
Yeah, I've seen his website and his books, and they are very thorough. I mean, I'm not, like I said, it's more like reference material for me because I don't do it very often. You know, I don't have to look at it. But what, as I mentioned, you know, seeing the power of volatility, it got me much more excited than some of the other even closed source tools out there. So you mentioned anti-forensics tools, that's a problem. I mean, you hear about that. Are there? What are some of the specific tools that people use to prevent that kind of visibility?
So there's two of the most popular tools that I've seen are CCleaner and Eraser. I've seen CCleaner on many investigations and not really on the IR space that I do the majority of my work now, but when I was in kind of a different role and my 24/7 job was getting computers from people inside of companies that were doing some kind of employee misconduct or they were ripping off their company some way, we had scripts written so that we could take a disk image after we had copied it and look for a bunch of anti-forensics tools, look for the traces of those. And many times we found CCleaner. And CCleaner, the purpose of it is to wipe out basically all the artifacts that forensics looks at. On the close to the end of our Black Hat course, what we do is we just have taught the students all the artifacts that you can find in forensics, all the ways you can use them to prove user activity. And then I pull up the CCleaner homepage where it lists all of the artifacts that it knows how to overwrite and to get rid of. And it's basically everything we went over in the class. I mean, the people that develop CCleaner know where the forensics community is looking and they know how to get rid of it. And going back to what I said about jump list, it was interesting where people were using CCleaner on Windows 7, but because jump lists weren't known about, the tool wasn't erasing them. So then the forensics community figured out, hey, these jump lists are here, they're surviving anti-forensics, and then a few weeks later, the next release of CCleaner added support for wiping jump lists. And so the same way the forensics analysts are keeping up with all these new artifacts and new analysis techniques, the anti-forensics community is as well. And CCleaner is a free tool you can go download. Attackers certainly, you know, we see they're on the IR side. We see attackers have their own versions of these tools to wipe out artifacts as well.
As part of the malware? Like they have CCleaner?
Either the malware or the attacker will pull scripts down to the machine after they've performed particular actions, and they can try to wipe event logs. They can try to wipe, link files, places that they know their malware is going to leave traces behind, or just the attacker kind of moving around your machine looking for files. Obviously, will leave traces. So,
yeah. I mean, do these guys take your classes?
I mean, we don't really. I don't know. They certainly could. There's some people who we've handed out the forms at the end at Black Hat, and the name is like John or Mike or something, and they don't talk much during the week. So.
So now, is CCleaner, is that primarily a Windows tool?
It's a Windows-only tool. There are equivalent tools like that. I don't. CCleaner is commercially supported. I don't know of really any Linux tools that have that level of commercial support. The other thing is Windows just stores so much more information than Linux does or Mac does that there's, I guess, more of a need for a tool that can find all of these places and wipe them versus on Linux you can kind of almost do it by hand if you know where to look. So
Windows is your friend.
From a forensics perspective, it's it really stores kind of a scary amount of information. And when I do like forensics talks or teaching people about it, some of the people ask, well, why does Windows store all of this? And some of the artifacts, there might be a logical reason Windows is storing it. Some of it, we don't know. It's not required for the operating system to function correctly. It's not required for some application. It's just information that's being stored.
Andrew, tell the truth. What operating system do you use personally?
My personal laptop is Windows 7, but I don't really – I do all my work in Linux, so really what I have is a bunch of Linux VMs that I SSH into. So I really only use the Windows side for like Firefox and chat and things like that. So.
Really? So you don't mind leaving those artifacts on your own?
My machine is locked down pretty well. I do have full disk encryption. I have some other ways as well. CCleaner might be installed on my machine. So,
Okay, cool. So you mentioned ambiguous data that as part of the problem. What do you mean by that?
This is a problem in forensics, and a lot of it goes on the Windows side. It goes back to Microsoft not documenting things, and so people will do research. They'll find a new file format, and then let's say they find a timestamp in the file format. Well, there's no documentation to say this timestamp gets updated when this particular event happens. So then what someone needs to do is build out a test system, build out a clean VM, and do actions on the machine and see which ones trigger that timestamp from updating or not, or which ones clear that timestamp. And that's okay kind of where forensics is at now because we've figured out a lot of the artifacts. But particularly when you look in the registry, you have all these keys. They have embedded timestamps, and for every one, someone has to go back and research and figure out when that actually gets updated. There's also shell bags are a really big thing in forensics. They're stored in the registry. They've only really been known, I would say, I guess, in the last year. Someone had reverse engineered the format of them inside the registry. Another person looked at them from what the format was actually storing as far as actions. And then even last week, Dan posted on his blog, it was like a 50-page blog post on shell bags because they're so complicated. And it was kind of just like a summation of this is everything researchers have figured out, and there's still a ton of things.
What's a shell bag? I'm sorry.
Okay. So a shell bag is it's another thing that it's Windows kind of stalking all the actions you do. So every time you use Windows Explorer, so when you're looking at files on your desktop, when you're dealing with zip files, when you're opening Windows, when you're searching inside of like zip or RAR files if you haven't fully extracted them yet, there's a huge number of artifacts, and Windows stores all of those within shell bags. So what you see is kind of this layered structure in the registry so that you can build out directory paths. So you'll see folder paths that are on disk, and that'll be in the registry. You'll see the names of all the files that were accessed. There's also timestamps associated with all those files. Your network share interaction. So if you go to like the start menu and type out an IP address or a domain name to a file server, that gets stored in shell bags. If you're clicking around folders inside of there, so if you're bouncing around in network share looking at different folders, those folders get stored inside of shell bags. And it really basically stalks everything you do inside of Explorer. And another nice thing about it is, let's say you have a Word document on your desktop and you open it. This could be something you copied from a network share or you downloaded off like a SharePoint site. Say it's a document that you're not supposed to have access to. You can look at that document and delete it, but the record inside of shell bags for that document with the file name and the timestamps associated with it don't go away. So you can actually see information on previous files that were stored throughout the file system, all in this registry portion.
So Windows is like the NSA.
Yeah, I mean, they really have. I mean, one of the reasons going through like trying to teach an entire course on the registry takes so long and requires so much materials because there's just so much there. The registry just kind of stalks everything you do.
So you also, we keep talking about encryption, but being in different workshops and over the last year, I understand the weaknesses in encryption, and it's not it's about the implementation of encryption often. For example, if you have full disk encryption, but you put your system to sleep, you can still recover. You might be able to recover the key from memory if you have physical access. But I mean, it still presents a problem for you in terms of if that you can't get that key from memory.
Yeah, it's definitely still an issue. And I mean, another thing is particularly where I'm doing incident response now, where I was at a smaller place before, but at the current company, there's people who all they do is collect evidence. And so I'm not going on site to collect evidence. Someone else does it, or one of our clients will send us evidence they have collected. And you don't really have a choice. You can have someone who doesn't know how to collect memory, walk up to the machine, pull the plug. Oh. Now the hard drive's encrypted in its offline state, and there's no memory there to get. The machine's already off. The person didn't capture it. So that's something we work with people quite a bit, is even if you don't know how to use volatility, you don't know how to use any other memory forensics tool, learn how to acquire memory, because there's going to be times you need it. And there are certainly cases where people have taken memory captures or even the hibernation file, if it was just like the data partition encrypted, and broken disk encryption that way. But if you just hand someone a hard drive that's encrypted with no supporting memory capture or anything like that, it basically comes down to brute forcing the password. So
yeah. So what are some of your favorite personal tools for Windows Forensics?
So at the file system level, definitely Sleuthkit. Sleuthkit is a open source project. It supports a crazy number of file systems, all the Windows ones, the Linux ones, Mac, FreeBSD ones. It supports the CD file system. So if you take a raw image of a CD drive. And Sleuthkit is very well known throughout the community. It was started from the command line. It actually started as Brian Carrier's master's project, and it's gone very far from there. There's now Autopsy, which is the graphical interface to it, has come a long way. So if someone doesn't want to sit on the command line driving all the tools, there's a web interface that automates a lot of the processing. But Sleuthkit is something, whenever I teach training or whenever I talk to someone in forensics to see if they really understand the deep structures, someone that can use Sleuthkit really understands file systems, because there are specific tools for, I want to parse this inode on disk, or I want to parse this MFT entry, I want to parse this specific block on disk. And if someone understands that, they really understand what's going on at the file system level.
And so what are some of the others? RegRipper, of course.
Yeah, for registry forensics, certainly Harlan's tool, RegRipper, also worked on registry decoder. I guess that's been like 2 years now or something, that NIJ had given us some funding for. So we certainly use Registry Decoder. There's times where kind of one tool is better than the other. Registry Decoder is really nice at search. RegRipper is really nice because of all the plugins it has in its command line, so you can automate the analysis. So certainly those are pretty much the only two tools I use for registry forensics.
Right, and of course you use Volatility.
Yeah, right. Of course.
Yeah. Now, a question came up. I went on our IRC earlier before the recording, and I said, okay, what do people want to ask about this? And somebody said, and everybody was complaining about Windows event logs. Now, from what I'm hearing, and, you know, you can't, if you're really doing forensics, if the person, if the attacker is halfway intelligent, hopefully they've been smart enough to, you know, at least on Linux, on Unix and Linux, they do this. They, you know, erase their tracks to some degree in the logs. But what do you use to parse event logs? You still acquire it, even though you're dubious that there may be information there, right?
Right. We certainly acquire them, and actually the way we've kind of scripted out our acquisition process is, we acquire memory from the machine first, obviously, and then we have sort of targeted files we look at. And for the two biggest one of those, we pull all the registry hives and we pull the event logs. And then to look at them, though, one thing to realize with people wiping event logs is that you certainly can do that. One thing, though, is if you need to wipe all of them, and people are used to, say, the application event logs or the system logs. But Jamie, that I work with and do the training with, she's the Volatility developer. She spoke at our workshop. She spent a lot of time on event logs and event log forensics. And she was looking on, I believe, a Windows 7 machine, and just on a base default install, there was over 60 event logs on the system.
Oh,
and so people, you know, attackers might wipe the security log or the system log, but they don't realize all these other ones are there. And she actually had a really interesting investigation where she talks about it in our class, but where someone had compromised an account, and then they realized that not just that one account had been compromised, but another domain account had been compromised, and they wanted to figure out which one it was. And so what she did is she started looking on the machine. She was looking at event logs, and there's an event log related to scheduled tasks, to jobs that are scheduled on the system. And when she parsed that event log, she saw that the scheduled task had been scheduled by the other account they were looking for. So by looking in that event log, they saw, okay, this task is running as this particular user. They didn't know at that point that user had been compromised. They knew another account had, but they didn't know which one. And at that point, they were able to recover it. And the reason they didn't know which account it was in the first place is because the attacker had wiped the security logs and the system logs and the application logs. So everything that you normally would look for to see which users are logging into a system had been wiped, but the attacker didn't know about this random other event log that the computer kept. And so.
Wow.
Now,
so what did you
now
use?
Was
to...
that on a now was that on a domain server or was that just on a standard Windows?
I think it was just on a. I think it was just on an end user system.
Really? So there's because you usually just hear about system security and application, but I guess there's what, like 57 other types that are just
I forget if she said it was Vista or Windows 7 or maybe both, but she said the default install has like 50 or 60 event logs.
So
that's the issue, right? If you're an attacker, you have to wipe all of those if you want everything to go away. And so
now what's a countermeasure to that? And I mean, I guess you could write all your logs to a log server. However, that could get fairly, that could fill up fast, require a lot of disk space if you have 50,000 workstations.
And it's excruciating with Windows because it's not like you just write to syslog, right? It with a Unix box. I mean, with Windows, you either have to have an agent or some kind of plugin. Mm-hmm. It's really excruciating from my perspective. But
I mean, I think by default, whenever you join a workstation to a domain, you get all the AD related logs recorded on the domain server, but all that other stuff that like the local logs that you get nothing, and you have to set up some separate process if you want to do that.
So, what do you use to parse Windows logs? What's your favorite thing to do that?
So you actually need two sets of tools because that was another thing that changed from Windows XP to Vista and 7 is there was all these really mature tools and understanding of what was in the format for XP. Vista and 7 comes out and it completely changed. So
on the XP
side, there's some tools from Harlan Carvey, some Perl scripts he wrote. He covers them in his book. Those work really well. On the 7, on the newer side with the XML binary format, I believe is it's called, you have Andreas Schuster, who's well known. He actually did a lot of the initial work on volatility and memory forensics. I believe he was the first one to reverse engineer the format. He also wrote some tools to parse them. Willie Ballantin from Mandiant also has a library in Python and some supporting tools to parse those event logs. And Harlan, I believe, also has some updated scripts to parse them. But again, it's kind of a pain because you have to know, okay, I'm on XP, I need this set of tools. I'm on Windows 7, I need this set of tools.
So now the tool that I've heard of, and maybe it was written by one of the folks that you mentioned there, is Log to Timeline.
Yeah,
any thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I was trying to remember the name of the project. I believe it's libevt or libevtx. It's from Joachim at Google on their IR team. And Log to Timeline is developed by Kristen on the Google IR team. So I believe what they did was integrated basically his event log parsing library into Log to Timeline. Log to Timeline is actually really nice for forensics of really any operating system because what it does is it goes through the file system, it goes through all of the files contained there, and it knows how to get timestamps out of everything. So it knows how to get timestamps out of the registry, out of the file system metadata, out of the event logs, out of link files, prefetch files, pretty much anywhere that forensics has found a timestamp of use. Log to Timeline has a parser for it, and so at the end what you get is this full timeline of everything that happened on disk. So you'll see when files were created, when files had been modified, you'll see when other interactions have, and timelining is a really powerful forensics technique, and the tool basically automates most of it for you, or it automates the pre-processing for you.
Okay.
Wow, it sounds excruciating. I mean, do you wish that, or maybe Windows actually, Microsoft has something in-house. I mean, is there any impetus to get them to make it easier for you guys by providing some tools?
I mean, they have some people on their forensics team who interact with the community. And, I mean, the problem is, you know, they're under NDA. They can't just, you know, hand us source code or they can't hand us, like, internal documentation. But it is nice when they clarify things or sometimes they'll do presentations on new artifacts. I don't see Microsoft just magically, at least to the private sector. There are programs for law enforcement where if they have a case and they see something they don't understand or they just need help with something or they can't, I haven't gone through that before. I've only heard about it and know what people have told me, and I've read a little bit about it. But essentially, Microsoft will help law enforcement if it's a case that's reasonable. But from the private sector, you're kind of on your own.
So. I guess maybe they feel like it could be used for nefarious purposes. So they are. It's a difficult situation, I guess. Well, let's dig into. Let's go back a little bit about the registry and discussion of sort of its purpose to the OS and the kind of artifacts that you can find there and that what you can leverage for forensics.
So the registry really has a huge amount of data, similar to event logs, how there's event logs for different purposes. There's different registry files on disk. They're normally called registry hives. So you have one called software. So this is related to things like software installation. There can be configuration data. It's also operating system components that you configure. So like your wireless drivers or your networking, those can be installed in the software or stored in the software hive. You also have the system hive, which stores a lot of information related to hardware. So the devices that are on your machine, USB devices that you plug in, those get stored inside the system hive. You also have the per-user hives. So when a user account is created, they get an NTUser hive. Depending on the Windows version, they also get a user class hive. And these are really nice because they store everything for a particular user account. So whereas if you see something in software or the system hive, you know what happened on the system, but you don't immediately know which user did it or which user account. With NTUser, you know this belongs to this particular user account. So if you see a document accessed or a website accessed or a file share accessed, you know that one particular account did it. And that's a really nice artifact because then you can pinpoint it on a user. You can figure out maybe that's the user account that was compromised or this is the user that, you know, is doing something inside, kind of like an internal attacker type scenario. And it's really just bookkeeping for the operating system. Anything the operating system or applications want to store can be stored in the registry.
I love that. Bookkeeping. That is it, yeah. Grex, isn't that great? Bookkeeping for the operating system. I love that. I'm writing that down.
Now, is there, I mean, the registry, it just continually grows. It's this massive steaming pile of something that, you know, just... It had this original purpose, but it just keeps on growing and growing, and they just keep on tacking on stuff and perhaps using it in ways that it wasn't meant to be used. I guess my question is, it's very complex and there's a lot of stuff. Is there one reference somewhere that you recommend going saying, hey, these are the 1,000 places you should check for doing registry forensics?
There are a few. So Harlan has an entire book on registry forensics.
Okay.
Those books are good.
which is at some point, I mean, the problem is there's so much, there's not like a one-page PDF someone can hand you and say this is everything that's in there. So Harlan's book is a really good resource. Another thing you can do is look at RedRipper or RegDecoder. So, for instance, you can see like the USB store plugin in RedRipper and see what part of the registry it's looking at. And that's often, I mean, some keys that we look at quite often, I just know off the top of my head, but many times if I have to go look at the actual raw hive itself, I have to go open like a RedRipper plugin and say, where is this reading to get its data from? And then go look there. On our masterclass through Hacker Academy, the registry class, we also spend quite a bit of time going through all of the artifacts that are stored in the hives. And that's one of the reasons the class is so long, is just getting through all of those takes a bit of effort. So.
So
cool.
When you say using the artifacts in the registry, using the registry to track user activity, can you talk about some examples of that?
Yeah, so some of the ones when we get asked kind of similar questions a lot, we have some that kind of make people say, wow, Windows really is stalking me in a kind of in a heavy way. The first one is every time you plug in a USB device, let's say, so for instance, the first time you plug it in, what gets stored in the registry is the time that you plugged it in, so that's going to become the last time you plugged it in. You get the model of the drive. You get what Microsoft terms the friendly name, which is normally the manufacturer, so Kingston or Patriot or something. It also records the serial number of the drive. So now, when you do forensics, you can say not only was removable media used, you can know the exact serial number of the drive. And we've used that artifact, for instance, in legal cases because we can see that people inside a company are putting, you know, sensitive company documents on removable media. We can prove like the time and the names of the files, and then we can go to court, or the person, the company, if it's not to that level yet, they'll deal directly with the person they're going after, and they'll say, look, we know you had this USB drive, this make, this serial number, you need to return that drive to us. And if the serial number wasn't there, they could just hand you any drive they wanted that kind of matched the description. But with the serial number, you know, some of them are printed on the drive, or you can like plug it into your own workstation and see what serial number gets populated. And then if you have the same thing, you know, you have the same drive. So that's something that's the first one that kind of freaks people out a lot. Another one is recent docs. So the way Windows does this is every time you open really any file on the operating system, that gets stored inside of the per user hive. So from a forensics perspective, you know which user did it. And it's also stored by file extension. So you'll see like the PDFs that were recently opened, the doc files, the XLS files. So you really get kind of a list of what the user had been doing on the machine. And again, that's also great for really a wide range of investigations. You can see what files were being viewed, where they were being saved, kind of how the user was moving around the machine. There's really many of them. Another one that normally kind of freaks people out is whenever you connect to a network, whether it's Ethernet or wireless, Windows stores the name of the network. So if it's a wireless network, that'll be like the SSID. It stores the IP address of the gateway, and I believe the MAC address of the gateway. And the other nice thing is it stores the first time you connected and the last time you connected. So when you're looking at a timeline, you can see, okay, at this point they connected to the network, they performed this activity, then they were off the network, and you know exactly what that person was doing. And I know police have used that to bust people who do like war driving, or they'll download some files or do some hacking off like a neighbor's wireless, and then they'll get suspicious and take the person's laptop who actually did it, and they'll say, yeah, at this time, you know, they were connected to their neighbor's wireless, or they were connected to like a Starbucks or something, and that's certainly been used in court against people.
So it's a one-stop shop. You can pretty much, even if you didn't have logs, you could get a lot from the registry.
Yeah, I mean, there's, particularly at the old company, where we were doing a lot of kind of corporate investigations on behalf of clients, there was times where, particularly once Registry Decoder was developed, because Registry Decoder automates a lot of things and does like automated reporting, we'd be done cases in like 20 minutes because they just wanted to know, was this particular document accessed? When did they do it? Was this particular USB drive used? Then you just look in the registry and you get the answer. Even cases that were very complex cases, the registry has its own data and it points you to where on the file system you should be looking for other artifacts that will be relevant.
And of course, inevitably, you know, one of us has to ask this: how hard is it or easy is it to cover your tracks in the registry? I mean, we all know in log files what you need to do, but
yeah. So CCleaner and other anti-forensics tools know all the artifacts I just spoke about. They know about the rest of them in the registry, and they do try to wipe those. Kind of one thing that can be done to counter, or I guess there's two things that can be done to counter that. One is most of the anti-forensics tools don't deal with backups. So, like on XP, your system restore points kept nearly full copies of what the registry looked like at that time. So you can just, if you have a system restore point that had artifacts you're interested in and those were from before the anti-forensics tool ran, you don't have to deal with the current set of hives. You can look at the backup ones. On Vista and 7, you have the volume shadow service and you can do the same thing. Another thing is, depending on how the tool actually deletes the keys, you might be able to recover the data. So what some tools do is just use the Windows API. They delete the values or they delete the keys. Some of them are a little smarter and will overwrite them with data before deleting them. But the ones that don't do that, there's this tool, RegLookup Recover. It was written by Timothy Morgan. He's probably he did some of the original documentation on the registry's format on disk. And what he also looked at as part of his research, or one of his research papers, was what happens when I delete something from the registry. So if I delete a value, if I delete a key, if I delete a key, what happens to the values under it? If I delete a value, can I still find the key it's associated with? And he found out many times you can. So another thing you can do is if you know an anti-forensics tool has been used on a set of registry hives, you can use Tim's tool, and what it'll do is basically go through the registry, look in the unallocated space, and bring some of that data back to life. So you can actually see what was there. Even though it's not active in the hive, it's still remnant within the hive file.
Well, then another thought, too, was that, you know, if you're a company and you want to prevent users from using tools like CCleaner, I mean, there's the whole whitelist approach. But also, I imagine that if you run users or that if you make sure that they're not being run as admin, you know, don't give them admin rights, CCleaner would be limited somewhat of what it can and cannot wipe.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Some of the places in the registry, like inside your user's end-to-user hive, are the permissions are so that the user can write into them. Mm-hmm. And there's actually a lot of really good artifacts in there, like in particular recent docs is stored in end-to-user. But certainly when you get to like the system and the software hive, those are locked down so that like an admin or an equivalent would have to write to them. And CCleaner doesn't only do the registry. It also does quite a bit of artifacts on disk, and it will work there as well. So some of those that it looks at are locked down to admin. Some are just for the user. Now, the other thing is I don't know if I've ever ran CCleaner not as admin, so I don't know if it's just going to break on the first thing that the first file that it can't access, but that would just be a programming error. Like that could be fixed through technical means.
Yeah. And then obviously with all the whitelisting products that are coming out now, that could be another way to limit the use of anti-forensics tools as well.
Yeah, but whitelisting tool, I mean, sit there and configure it all. It's like it gets to be its own thing.
We can't say the W word, right?
Is that what?
The W word.
Whitelisting or Windows?
Yeah, whitelisting.
I mean, it's hard. It never gets any easier, it sounds like. And then, so I'm hearing about malware that's coming out that can, it just runs completely in memory. I'm hearing stuff about that. I'm reading about that. I mean, is that accurate?
Yeah, that's actually been around for a while. It just, people started, I guess, finding it more interesting, or maybe they were starting to see samples that they could comment on publicly. But some of the first instances of that was actually in the precursors of Metasploit. So if you look at, I don't know their real names, but like Scape and some of the guys that wrote the Uninformed Journal before they all moved on to Microsoft, they had actually, on Windows and Linux, had this notion of, okay, we exploit something over the network, say it's FTP server, say it's something like built into the operating system. Why do we need we're exploiting that over the network, we're exploiting it in the memory of a process. Why do we want to start writing stuff to disk that AV is going to pick up? Forensics was kind of coming, you know, disk forensics was coming along at that point. They're going to find us. So if we can do everything in memory, it won't be there. So Metasploit still has that to this day. If you use the, what they call it. I think they just call it the remote library injection payload. Forget the exact name.
It's slightly different now. There's something, for example, with Windows, that's a lot harder, right?
I don't think so. I mean, like Meterpreter does it. I just don't remember what the underlying like Metasploit term for it is. But it's this notion of like you're in the memory of a process, and what they can do is like read DLLs over the network, read custom code over the network, and essentially what you have in memory is like a stager. So you have like a mini Windows loader that can get that DLL loaded without actually using the operating system to do it. So again, nothing's written to disk. You're not going through the normal Windows API. So if you look at, if you use like the standard, say, volatility plugin to list DLLs that relies on the same data structures, the API's update, it's not going to find it. So then you have to use like the malware plugins to look for, hey, there's this DLL here that the normal plugin didn't find, that's something suspicious. So it's definitely an issue. And it was also interesting, the last time we did the volatility class, FireEye did a blog post on like the diskless malware, I think they called it. And we actually had someone from the FireEye IR team in our class at that time. And he's like, yeah, everyone at work has been talking about it. It's really cool. Basically, we wanted to look at it like we were going to go back and do like a volatility blog post on it. But in the meantime, while we're teaching the class, Russ from Microsoft, one of their big forensics guys, did a blog post, and a few other people started looking at it with volatility. And sure enough, you know, when you point volatility at it, you know, all the malware stuff comes back to life. So.
Yeah, that's what I was – I've been reading some of those blog posts. I guess they're different because you're actually – you're not doing it on the network. You're doing it on the system, but you're not leaving artifacts. It's totally in memory. I guess that's where the subtlety is, right?
Yeah, and it's a huge issue because we talk to people, and there's actually someone in our last Black Hat class who was telling us, I guess it was like 2 years ago, and memory forensics was not well known, a lot of people weren't doing it. And he's like, yeah, we had this case where we could see a machine beaconing out to like a command and control server. We'd unplug the machine, we do disk forensics, nothing there. We turn it back on. 30 minutes later, you know, our IDS is freaking out again because it sees this traffic leaving, and eventually we just wiped the disk because we didn't know what to do. And he realized kind of after, he's like, okay, this had to be something in memory that, you know, we weren't finding on the disk. And now, you know, memory forensics would find that, but you still have the same problem. People want to say, is this – basically, if people come to me and they say, yeah, this machine is secure or it's not compromised, and you ask them what they do and they only say disk forensics, well, that you can't really believe them at that point. You also need to do the looking at memory as well.
Yeah, but now the problem is – so when you start getting into memory forensics and the diskless malware, I mean – what do you do? I mean, so the registry then gives you nothing. Event logs and registry. I mean, is there any artifact that you can find? Do you have to pull the registry live? It might be there, and then the malware it might be in, and then it removes it. I mean, are you going to find anything? Do you think?
Looking from a disk forensics perspective, there's a distinct possibility you won't find anything. There's also some artifacts that can be left. For instance, depending on how the machine's configured, you have prefetch files so that every time a program runs it, the prefetch stores information about basically what happened within like the first 10 seconds of execution, whatever DLLs loaded, the paths that were being utilized. And that's a really nice artifact because then you can see all programs that execute on a system. So even if you have this malware that loads itself in memory, but at some point it drops a binary to execute, or let's say, you know, you have an interpreter, you log into this shell that's only in memory, well, you're still running tools on Windows. You want to, you know, use ipconfig, or you want to use the net command. So there can be like indirect evidence that a machine was compromised, but depending on how the attacker operates, there's certainly ways of not leaving anything on disk.
Well, your job just gets harder every year, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a good selling point, though. It's like, see, you know, we tell people, like, hey, you should have been using memory forensics all this time. And now there's, like, you know, there's some concrete proof in the public that we can show. I mean, we do a lab in our memory forensics class with a machine that's compromised with an interpreter. And the question, we don't really give any hints before. And it's like, find the malware, find this. And Volatility has plugins to pull some file system data out. Like you can extract the registry out of memory, the event logs out of memory. But really what you have to do is use the malware plugins to find these discrepancies of how the code loaded itself in memory. And that's the only way you're going to find it. So.
What would you say, and maybe Greg, so you can speak to this too a little bit. What would you say the percentage right now is in terms of disk forensics, you know, and looking at the registry and things like that and artifacts physically there versus memory forensics, you know, how is that balanced out right now in the community in terms of which one is still most useful? I see that memory forensics is becoming more and more powerful in terms of, you know, some lately you'll talk to people and they won't even do disk forensics at all. They'll do, they call it live forensics, and they'll focus on memory, and they may pull the registry hive, but they're not going to go through the painfully slow process of going through the disk. What do you think is the percentage of cases that are becoming more focused on memory versus disk?
I mean, this can't really talk to it too much, but I mean, I think, you know, the bread and butter is doing the hard drive based forensics. I think, you know, we're probably just in the beginning stages of companies and other organizations starting to put the tools and the technology in place so that they can do memory forensics.
Do you think that's true, Andrew? Is that...
Yeah, it's definitely, I mean, it's a lot better than it was 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, but there's still companies that only do disk forensics, and a lot of times what it takes is sort of an advocate in the company to show this is what we're missing from not doing memory forensics. We've had people take our volatility course who are more at the manager level than the actual hands-on level, because that's what they wanted to know. Like, they wanted to see, is it worth bringing this process into the company? Is it worth getting, you know, the teams that are under them trained up on these skills? And people, there's definitely still people kind of figuring out. In some of your more sophisticated labs, memory forensics is done every time. Memory samples are taken every time. But unless there's someone leaves from a company that was doing it and goes to another company, it just kind of requires someone to convince a company to do it. So.
I didn't even think it was a political issue. It's funny.
It costs money, so
yeah,
it becomes a political issue. So for companies that are just looking to get started, are there any tools that you recommend that they can use to just try out? You know, maybe something that, you know, that they can remotely take snapshots, or maybe something that takes a memory dump, you know, at periodic, like 3 times per day, so that you could have like a history that you could go back to. Anything like that?
Yeah, from the learning memory forensics side or how to do it, Volatility is open source and free. We have on our wiki on the Google Code site, we have every plugin documented with output on like a memory sample and explaining what it means. We also have memory samples that people have released public for kind of I guess like the forensics version of Capture the Flag or just forensics challenges.
Oh, cool.
And people go through those. Also on the wiki, we have our community documentation project, which is where we link to basically anyone in the community who writes about memory forensics, whether it's using Volatility or some other tool. I believe that goes all the way back to like 2009. There's probably over 200 documents, and we have some that are easier to understand, so not like the deep malware analysis right away, but kind of showing how in a normal forensics investigation or an IR investigation without malware or sophisticated malware, how you can use memory forensics, and people will take the time to read those, and then they'll try out some of the commands themselves and kind of get a feel for how the tool works.
Wow, that's a good idea.
So that's forensicswiki.org?
No, it's the Volatility Google Code.
Oh, the Volatility, okay.
We have the Google Code site, and then Google Code gives you the ability to write like a wiki for your project.
Okay, nice.
And so we have everything documented there. For your question about the acquisition side, for people that just want to practice, a lot of times what they do is if you have like VMware, even like Workstation or I think Player lets you snapshot, you can suspend the VM or snapshot the VM, and then you're going to get either a .vmem file or a VMSS file. That is exactly what RAM looked like at the time that the virtual machine was suspended, and you can just point Volatility at that. So people will try different flavors of Linux. They'll install Windows 7 and put some tool on it. People obviously do this for malware analysis as well. The Cuckoo Sandbox, which is an open source malware sandbox, actually integrates with Volatility now. So you can tell it to when it's essentially snapshotting its own information, it can kick off Volatility in the background and take a memory dump and get that information as well. So.
Nice. Yeah,
that's
then
awesome.
I think the other thing that you mentioned, and this was on your Google Wiki, was the availability of memory dumps that you can analyze for sort of a Capture the Flag.
Are you you're asking where to get those, or just how?
Oh, yeah. Was that on your Google project?
Oh yeah.
Or
so
your Google project, or?
So if you look at the wiki, I believe there's a page like public samples or public images or something like that.
Nice.
And those all link to them. Some of the ones on the Windows side, DFRWS at 2005 did what's now like a very famous forensics challenge that was actually the catalyst for a lot of initial memory forensics research into Windows, because there was volatility was young then. There was not a whole lot of other tools. And normally the DFRWS challenge is like, if you want to do it, you have to write your own tool and do your own research. It's not just to run like other people's stuff. And there's been several since then. I would MHL, one of the volatility developers, the guy who wrote the Malware Analyst Cookbook, he also has a lot of samples that were part of that book with different malware installed. So there's some with like Zeus, Poison Ivy. He has one for that's infected with Stuxnet. And so people like to take those memory samples and see, you know, the malware come out in memory, or you run some of the plugins and show you directly like where the system has been hooked. So people like to go through those as well.
So what's your favorite memory acquisition tool?
We have two. It depends on the context. So if I'm walking up to some random machine that I haven't seen before, isn't part of our network, George Gardner writes a commercial tool, KNTDD. He actually spoke at the Open Memory Forensics Workshop on memory.
Oh, yeah. I remember him. He was cool.
Yeah, so he has a lot of experience in the field doing acquisition in some very interesting places. So his tool basically can never break. It has to be very accurate. He also tries a number. He doesn't really publish all the ways his tools work, because he's in environments where if attackers know that, then they can try to subvert the tool or break the tool. But we fully trust his tool. We've used it many times in the field. If you're talking about on an enterprise level, anywhere more than anything past like a small company, we use F-Response. So what F-Response does is, depending on what version you have, like there's the kind of a version you can walk up to any machine. There's also the enterprise version that does it for you. But what it does is it exports the raw disk and memory as a device file, like an iSCSI device. And you can connect to it with, say, a Linux machine. And then what you get is you'll get like dev-sdb, which will be the disk of the machine you connected to, and dev-sdc will be the memory. So at that point, you can run DD over those and acquire them. You can run sleuthkit or these other tools directly against it. You can run volatility directly against the what's being exported as memory. Nice. And in our own environment, where we are, basically in charge of finding malware and stuff on thousands of machines, we have F-Response all over the place, and we have scripts around volatility and other tools, and those can just run 24/7 looking for malware. You can look across all these machines without actually pulling memory, because when you run volatility on your locally mounted memory image that's actually connected to another machine on the network, you're not doing a full memory capture every time. We did some testing, and if you run, say, like the PSList plugin that list processes, you're pulling like less than 100K of data over the network, but you're getting that live from the machine, and so you can constantly be seeing, polling on the machine for malware that's there. If new processes are there, you can get some really powerful analysis that way.
What's your favorite open source memory acquisition tool?
The Windows side, Dumpit was definitely my favorite tool for a while. The problem is there's been some very documented cases of when you get to like 64-bit Windows 7 and machines with more than 8 gigs of RAM, it produces memory dumps that aren't very accurate. But kind of anything outside of that, that's been like the go-to tool for the community. It was open source for a while, but it's always been free. And it was nice because you didn't have to do anything. Like you could put on a thumb drive. It was pre-compiled. It wrote out to the same directory that you ran it from. So you could just walk up with your USB drive, double-click the executable, and a few minutes later you would have your memory dump on the USB drive and you could walk away. So a lot of people still rely on Dumpit. It's pretty much the main tool. Like there's some other ones. I don't want to name them if I'm going to say they're bad, but there's a tool that some people rely on, but it's kind of like a bloated GUI. And so if you look at like when you're just running that tool before you click on the things to dump memory, all of the information it's scattering around memory, it's kind of wiping away more evidence and more memory pages than is really necessary.
Is that by a company that we all know as a forensic company?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Most likely.
Okay.
So
that's all we need to say.
So on the free side, pretty much Dump It would be the main one. It's just unless there's going to be updates to that free one to fix some of the issues. I'm kind of hesitant on newer machines because if you walk up to a server, it's certainly going to be 64-bit. It's most likely going to have more than 8 gigs of RAM, and we've had just a lot of cases of inaccurate memory dumps in those situations. So,
well, what do you recommend? And I suppose you already said that F-Response does this, but you're basically just want to like quick triage. Like you walk up to a box and you want something that collects memory, and it collects all like the relevant registry files and the relevant event logs and things like that. Is there an open source tool that does that?
Off the top of my head, I don't. There's some. I just don't know what state they're in. Like, for instance, there was an I'm not getting the name wrong. There was an auto rip project by Corey Harrell, and I just don't remember which evidence that it pulls, but I know that was kind of the goal of it, was to quickly pull things off a machine. But I don't know of anything outside of that open source that you could just directly kind of pull the data you want. I mean, the stuff we wrote, it's simple enough. But I don't know of anything that will pull all of the artifacts at once. There's some tools that will just pull like the registry files, but then you're kind of on your own for the event logs and stuff.
In terms of open source, there are certainly commercial tools that will like.
I know of commercial tools that will do it. I just don't know if anyone's released anything open source. I was even trying to think if there was just like free but not open source tools that did it, and nothing was really coming to mind.
Yeah, because the way I see it is, it would be just something that you would have on a USB stick. You just pop it in, double click something, and then it collects all the relevant stuff that an investigator could look at later without having too much of an impact on the end user. Just in cases where they're not sure if a machine is infected or not.
Oh, you want to put them out of a job. You want to make it too easy.
No. We want to pull the data that allows them to do their job better.
Oh, okay.
So
I know what you're asking for, and unfortunately I don't really know of anything, and it might just be the case I don't know of it because we kind of wrote our own stuff for people to go on site with, and then at a network level we just used like F-Response to give us that without actually walking up to each individual machine. So
okay, yeah, because I've seen tools and most of them are custom depending on the organization that you're looking at, but I was just curious if there was stuff like that was out there available in the open source community so that users could, or so that smaller orgs could have something at least to start with or to experiment with, or that folks, that are trying to get involved into or in the forensics field could just use to sort of play with and learn off of.
Yeah. It's tough.
Anyway, yeah.
So, it seems like we've covered a lot, and, I'm sure listeners, their brains are sort of bleeding out of their ears a little bit, because it's a lot of information if you don't do forensics or on a regular basis. And I think it's great to mention that we've talked about a lot of the books by Harlan Carvey. There's certainly some great forensics websites out there that have a lot of great information. We'll have those in the show notes. Of course, there's Volatility. There's great material on the blog there. Of course, there's the class, which is great. I'm really happy to see that Hacker Academy and you are teaching and getting the information out there that makes it a little more accessible for people, even if they're not going to go out and do a forensics engagement. Very often, at least, they understand it. So it helps you actually do your job a little more easily as well. So does anybody have their security New Year's resolutions coming up? Grex, do you have any for this year?
I don't know, but that sounds like a good blog post. Thanks for the idea.
Man, no.
Think about that one.
So what are your New Year's resolutions, Andrew, for security? What would you like to do?
Yeah, it's interesting you ask that because I actually was talking with a local friend within the last couple weeks about that. And he's not solely focused on memory forensics, but he does kind of forensics and penetration testing. And we're talking about how you get very specialized in something. So obviously a large part of my working time is like memory forensics volatility. A lot of his are on other tools. And there's a lot of other stuff going on in the forensics and security world besides memory forensics. And so we kind of compiled a list of books that we were going to get on these other topics. We did a big Amazon order, and that's kind of our New Year's thing is not kill ourselves. We don't want it to be painful, but you know, if it's an hour a day, an hour every other day, like actually sit down with a book outside of our specialization to make sure we're keeping up with like other technologies as well.
So. I find that so hard. I mean, it's interesting that you say that because there just doesn't seem to be enough time. And then it's at some point you can't take any more in, right? Because your brain just gets tired and you need to do other things, or if you have kids or...
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, it's going to be none of us sleep very much, so it's kind of like it's going to cut into the already lack of sleep to try to keep up on things. But it's also I think it's important because you don't want to be so focused on something that you get asked like a really basic question about something else that the entire rest of the community does, and you just have no idea because you're so tunnel vision on like your area.
Well, if I can offer a great way is to contribute to a podcast or
contribute to a blog,
right? Yeah. I do a lot of writing now for different publications, and it actually it forces me to get out of my little niche and shell, because I try to be very generalist because I think that's what's needed in the security community sometimes, because we do have a lot of people who are specialists, and somebody needs to be able to bring all of it together as well. But I think it's great that you mentioned that because it's, you know, forensics is on my list of something that I want to spend more time with. But
I think one of the things that I have as part of my sort of to-do list that I want to do on a weekly basis that I very rarely do, but is, you know, on Saturday afternoon, schedule 2 hours to just go to a bookstore, you know, and hang out in their computer security section and just find interesting things and just read them and just skim it. And then every so once in a while, you'll find a good book, you know, and buy it and take it home and finish reading it. But
how retro.
Just
you were
getting...
so retro, Grex. Bookstore, well, paper.
Like... No. We'll see what we spend like 90% of our time in front of computers. And so it's just nice to get out every once in a while. So that's nice because you can go out. You have a range of topics that you can look at. Or a better option is if you have a good library, you know, just go there and just read and skim stuff and find stuff that interest you. But that's one idea but like I said, that's been something that is on sort of my weekly to-do list. But I think over the past year, I've probably done it maybe once, but at least it's one better than zero. So, you know, hey.
Okay. So we're all in agreement that our New Year's resolution should be that we try to learn something out of our comfort zones.
Yeah.
In another area of security. That's fair.
Yep.
Okay. So we'll check in a year from now and we'll see how we all did.
Yep.
Well, that seems like a good point to end. Well, it's the end of another episode, and I hope everyone had as much fun as we did. Please join me in thanking our sponsor, Hacker Academy, teaching InfoSec from the hacker's perspective. With training modules available 24/7, you'll have plentiful pwnage to practice 365 days a year. I hope you can follow us on the Twitter at Packet Pushers or at Mrs. Y is Y. You can also find us hiding on Google+. Remember to spend time with the other listeners in IRC at Freenode. Visit packetpushers.net to read blogs by the anonymous Packet Pushers followers, or novainfosec.com. Subscribe to our RSS feeds and donate to the show, because we're running out of tinfoil. Email your comments or questions about the show to healthyparanoia@packetpushers.net. And remember, it's healthy paranoia, because sometimes they really are out to get you. Are you listening, NSA?